Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Good evening to you. As it turns out, the word fan and fanatic share a common origin. The Latin fanum meaning temple and fanaticus meaning insanely but divinely inspired. Tonight's event sold out in 42 seconds, a record. When we had President Clinton with John Hope Franklin, it took six times longer, 4 minutes and 7 seconds. A similar situation when Norman Mailer met Günter Grass on this stage. 42 seconds. When I told Jay-Z's people, I'm interviewing Jay-Z with Cornel West on November 15th, they said, we will do better. Well, let's see. Ladies and gentlemen, Rolling Stone fans, good evening again. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library. My goal is simply, as you have heard me say 100 times, but not all of you have, so for the 4 people who have not heard me say this, my goal here is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when I'm successful, to make it levitate. Boy, oh boy, are they ever roaring, those 2 lions. They have names, patience and fortitude. And are we ever live and alive tonight? I would like to thank the Board of Trustees of the New York Public Library and its president, Paul Leclerc, for recognizing that the New York Public Library and public libraries in general can be among the most exciting, jubilant places in the world. Places from where to discover the world. There are 5 people I would like to thank. Please hold your applause until I have mentioned these 5 names. So count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Patti Smith for early on putting in a good word. Michael. That was 1. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Patti Smith for early putting in a good word. That was 1. Michael Peach, the executive vice president and publisher of Little Brown and Company, who considered my invitation to Keith Richards seriously. Jane Rose, Keith Richards' extraordinary manager. What, you don't like Michael Peach? That's why you're applauding? No. Ed Victor, Keith Richards' extraordinary agent. And last, soon you can applaud, but not least, Meg Stemmler, the producer of All Live from the New York Public Library happenings, for making all things fall into place with grace. Tonight, a conversation between Keith Richards and Anthony De Curtis. Anthony De Curtis has written frequently about both Keith Richards and the Rolling Stones. In the course of his 30-year career as a music journalist, most notably for Rolling Stone, where he's a contributing editor. He's also, in other words, artists talk about life and work, and editor of Blues and Chaos, the music writing of Robert Palmer. He teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania and lives in New York City, where he was born and bred. Anthony De Curtis.
I see the joint was rocking, going round and round. They're reeling and rocking, what a crazy sound. And they never stopped rocking, till the moon went down. It sounds so sweet.
This is how Michiko Kakutani, one of the toughest book reviewers at the New York Times, starts her review of Keith Richards' new book, his memoir entitled Life. For legions of Rolling Stone fans, Keith Richards is not only the heart and soul of the world's greatest rock and roll band, he's also the very avatar of rebellion, the desperado, the buccaneer, the poet maudit, the sole survivor and main offender, the torn and frayed outlaw, and the coolest dude on the planet. It's a word that I never use, but I like using it. The coolest dude on... I think it's dude. On the planet, named both number one on the rock stars most likely to die list and the one life form beside the cockroach capable of surviving nuclear war. Halfway, she says, through his electrifying new memoir life, Keith Richards writes about the consequences of fame, the nearly complete loss of privacy and the weirdness of being mythologized by fans as a sort of folk hero renegade. In his memoir, Keith Richards writes, I can untie the threads of how much I played up to the part that was written for me. In early summer, following statement caught my eyes. I read that when Keith Richards was a child, he wanted to be a librarian. Doesn't surprise you, it would seem. He said that growing up in England, two institutions mattered to him most. The church, which belongs to God, and the library, the public library, which belongs to the people. The public library, he said, was the great equalizer. Upon reading this, I thought to myself, let's bring the librarian into the library. And I called up Michael Peach and basically said, we have to have him come here. And he said, write a little note. And in essence, this is what I said. I said, Keith Richards can go three places. He can go to the White House. He can go to the Library of Congress, but the place where he really, really belongs is the New York Public Library. And so, here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the New York Public Library, your fans here in Manhattan, in the United States, and around the world, people were standing in line this morning at about 8 a.m., I am thrilled to bring to this stage tonight, live from the New York Public Library, the great Keith Richards.
Always burn a hole in my pants. Never get the score on a happy baby. Always do a second chance. I need a love, keep me happy.
Oh, we haven't even said anything yet.
No. Yeah.
Well, Keith, of course, it's such a delight to have you here. I remember the first time I interviewed you, I was asking about how really the world had changed since, you know, the Rolling Stones had started out. And if you had some sense about, you know, the things that made the biggest impression on you. And the thing that you said really surprised me, because the first thing you said was, nobody reads anymore. And I wanted to, you know, since we're in the library here, I wonder if you could talk about your own love of books, your own, you know, you have great libraries yourself, and what reading meant to you when you were a kid.
Sure. Dartford Public Library, I mean, it was nothing like this, believe me. to me, I don't know, it was a place where... you got a sort of hint that maybe there was a thing called civilization. Yeah. It was the only place around where you had, I willingly would obey the rules, like silence, please. You know, I tiptoe like the best of them, man. And I think it was that sort of different space that is. It's there for everybody. I mean, I still owe fines from about 50 years ago. Astronomical by now, I should think. But it was somewhere where I could find out things I wanted to find out about, you know, that you weren't necessarily being taught at school. that, and you just get a certain interest in something, and you say, well, I know where to go to find out a bit more about this, and it would be, you know, the library, you know. And I don't know, in England, all public libraries actually, I think, were designed and built by the same guy in any town, but you knew where you were just because there was the library. And it was always like the center of things, and it, so it should be, you know. I mean, they're not keeping all these books for nothing, are they?
Yeah. No, not at all. And now yours is among them.
Yeah, so that's a first for me.
And hopefully not the last.
Volume two's in the works.
Very good. Well, you know, you've written very eloquently in the book about, you know, growing up in England after the war and a kind of childhood that I think is different from the childhood that even many Americans who went through World War II had. I wonder if you could talk about, you know, just what the atmosphere was like, what your childhood was like a little bit, and what are your kind of most kind of compelling memories of that.
Growing up is, it was, basically we were a bit on the front line, you know, there was, rubble everywhere, and if there was a building left, fantastic. But at the same time, being so young, I was not aware that there was any other world apart from, you know, bombed out ruins. To me, it's perfectly natural. It's only slowly I realized that this was not supposed to be the normal state of things, you know, that things were supposed to be more normal, whatever that is. And it gave you a sense of thinking that there must be something else. To my generation, I think, that this wasn't normal and that we'd better get on with it and over it. And to me, of course, at my age, rock and roll has turned the world from black and white into technicolor, just like that. And suddenly everything became possible.
Can you talk about some of the first things you heard and the kind of impact it had on you, and what you heard in that music?
I heard exuberance, a sort of new, a potential new way of looking at things, or at least listening to things. I think maybe a lot of it is generational, because of the guys that were doing it in America, after we were listening to American music, and that was basically our lifeline in those days. You can ask the Beatles or, you know, the Stones and any other English rock and rollers from my generation, is that sense of there's something happening and you just want to be part of it, you know, and you jumped in with both feet. At least I did.
Now, you talked about hearing music in your family, you know, your grandfather in particular, your mother, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about the kind of music that you encountered from them and what your use for that was emotionally.
Basically, I've got to say, and what America maybe should realize more about itself, that the last century or two have been, the rest of the world has been fascinated by American music, maybe because there are so many different cultures being arriving here and learning how to integrate and cross-sections, ideas are coming across from different cultures, which you didn't have in Europe. We had the polka, the odd waltz, you know. But the American music had... My mother, I listened growing to American music, jazz, basically, you know, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald. So I've been brought up on American music without even knowing it. I can't really say strong enough. I mean, even the Nazis had jazz bands, you know, can you believe this? The force and power of American music has probably been the most sort of underrated or unrecognized forces that have come out of this country. Yeah. I couldn't wait to get here. And I haven't left since, really.
Well, one day at a train station, there's a fabulous letter in your book. You ran into another lover of American music. His name is Mick Jagger. He's carrying a couple of records. Chuck Berry, I believe, maybe Muddy Waters.
He was.
Talk about that meeting and what it meant for you, even at the time.
At the time, I had a certain recognition suddenly between Mick and myself in that railway carriage. You know, what a few years had done, and that something had brought us to a point of burning interest, which was basically the blues, you know, and rock and roll thrown in, because it's very hard to pull those two apart. You can't take the blues out of any American music. It's there. I think it was kind of a shock, and suddenly that we were both into this music at the same time. The fact that we should just happen to meet again out of nowhere became... Also, I wanted to steal the records if I could get away with it. And so from there on, it went on. You know, I said, oh, where did you get those records? And he said, Chicago. And so we started from there, and I've been trying to steal his records ever since.
You know, in times that I've interviewed, you know, people like Willie Dixon or, you know, John Lee Hooker, you know, they were astonished that young white guys and women in England knew their music. You know, they were so used to essentially being completely unknown, you know, to the vast majority of white people here. I was wondering what you heard in that music. You know, what was it that was there that spoke to you so powerfully, even though, you know, culturally, you know, your circumstances were so different?
I think there's the force, the drive, and this other way of looking at music. I mean, suddenly you're not listening to I'm a pink toothbrush or a blue toothbrush. I mean, these guys are singing about life. You know?
And, to coin a phrase.
Yeah. And George, that was a heavy-duty lift of like where music could affect people and how and the power of it. And I think that those guys, to us, sort of opened the scales fell, you know, and suddenly you knew exactly what it is you wanted to do. And also the joy of being able to translate that back into America and back to those guys. You know, there's a sort of circle happened. Why English guys suddenly need to teach Americans about the blues? Now, that's a kind of something I've never been able to figure out. But anyway, it grabbed us, and all we wanted to do was to grab other people with it. And to be able to sort of meet Muddy, John Lee Hooker. My first tour was Bo Diddley, you know, and just to be able to exchange ideas about music and the power that it actually can have over people, used correctly.
Of course, only as prescribed. If you could talk about, say, meeting some of those guys, you know, what were your impressions of those, you know, everyone, you know, ooh. I mean, the first time I met you, I mean, it was amazing to me, you know, being such a fan. And, you know, meeting your heroes can be a tricky business sometimes. I wonder if you could talk about the first time you met Bo Diddley or Muddy Waters or John Lee Hooker.
I think what struck me about all of those guys was their incredible humility and their incredible, they were gentlemen. You know, I mean, these comes from pretty tough guys, you know. I mean, but in their way that they explained themselves to you and the way they took you into their hearts, it was almost like long-lost brothers. And it's a feeling I've never forgotten. And I have woken up in Howling Wolf's house once or twice, you know? Which is a trip in itself. But,
Well, you know, their music also, I mean, one of the most compelling sections, of the many compelling sections in the book, your descriptions of you and Mick and Brian Jones, and, you know, in this little apartment, you know, just kind of studying this music and trying to, you know, to see how you can get inside it and convey it. And, you know, can you talk about the, you know, the kind of enthusiasm that you guys felt at that time, well, about each other and about the possibility and about what the music was?
I think we were slightly amazed that we actually found each other and that we could actually sit around and listen to these guys, Jimmy Reed, you know, as I go through the whole litany of Elmore James, and actually begin to figure out, oh, I mean, it's not so much just the musicality of it. It's got to do with being able to express it, to be able to put it over, in other words, and to convey ideas, and especially to convey feeling. And I mean, I've never forgotten what I learned from those guys. And as I, when we started, we were so idealistic, it was ridiculous. You know, all we wanted to do was to turn other people on to those guys. You know, that was the name of the game. It didn't matter. I mean, money, forget about it. It was just this idealistic sense of everybody should hear this music. And since, you know, they're not going to hear the real guys, we'll do second best. And that was our kind of feeling on it. But it was evangelical almost.
You know? You know, as that was happening, suddenly, of course, the Beatles exploded. They came to the United States, you know, really for the first time. People here began, you know, the idea that rock and roll was kind of an English thing. I wonder what that looked like from your vantage. You know, were you a Beatles fan? Were you someone who loved the music? I mean, how did you see all that, you being you? You being Keith Richards. I sort of feel like Chris Farley or something doing this interview. I was like, you're awesome.
How did I feel? The Beatles, let's say, first off, the Stones, when we first heard the Beatles, there was a sort of feeling of, you mean there's other guys doing this stuff? You know? We thought we're the only island of hope. And to realize these guys, and also they beat us to the punch there, you know, but they were a little older than us. a year or two, you know. We felt a certain bond between those guys and ourselves, because you're not alone, suddenly. You know that there's... And, of course, they took off so enormously and so fast that... You know, then people started to consider that there was some competition between us, but I could never, ever felt that way. I mean, we realized other people did. You know, there could be, you know, Stones or the Beatles. But between ourselves, it was a great camaraderie. And there was a little competition there, of course, because you've got to have a little poke, you know. I mean, but at the same time, for instance, we would always work together if they had a record coming out. And they'd call us up and say, how's your new one? You know, and, we'd say, it'll take us a couple of weeks. Said, okay, we'll go first, and we'd rather than clash with each other. There was always a feeling that we should work together on this. None of us expected what happened to happen. I mean, even to get to the States was Yeah, dream about it, pal.
The you know, again, another interesting section in the book is where you talk about the differences between the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Mm. And a very interesting conversation you had with John Lennon, in which you were explaining to him, you know, why the Beatles could rock but not roll. And I wonder if you could rehearse a little of that for us.
Maybe. I think the difference is the Beatles and the Stones. The Beatles are primarily a vocal group. You know, they were harmonies, they were singing. And it didn't really matter whether Paul was singing the lead or John was singing the lead or George, whatever. I mean, that was interchangeable with the Beatles. With the Stones, we were more instrumental, and we had one front man. And he better be good, right? And he was the best.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was that moment when the Rolling Stones came to the U.S., and you know, you've described here, you know, what America meant to you. What did it look like when you arrived? And obviously, I mean, I think you came to New York first, and then went on out into the rest of the country. I wonder if you could talk about some of the contrasts of those experiences.
Oh, in the early 60s in America, yeah, incredible difference between, you know, what we called the outside, the edge, you know, which is New York, Chicago, Frisco, LA, you know, Florida maybe, but the difference between the big cities and Oklahoma. it was immense at the time. And we could make contact with a lot of city people. But quite honestly, for a year or so, we were total freaks out there. You know, and you got used to being, I'm a freak, you know. Have a good laugh. You know. But at the same, they couldn't understand why young kids were coming to see us play, I think. There was, and they had weird laws, like, you know, about, you know, smoking backstage and stuff. And you never knew quite where you were, because that state would have one law and then there'd be another law. You know. So you're always trying to figure out quite where you were. This is Missouri? Okay. Okay, we'd be on our best behavior. And things like that. But it was still known as the Bible Belt. You know, and I mean, communications not being quite what they are today. You kind of felt that you were probably back 20 or 30 years at the time from, say, being in the Big Apple, you know, which is rocking, you know.
Yeah, people got it, sure.
Always was and always will, probably. But the difference was immense at the time. But I got to say, I learned a lot by doing those treks down through the South and the Midwest in 64s and 65 and stuff. Another world. And it's still the Mason-Dixon line.
Well, you write, I mean, really intriguingly about crossing some of those racial boundaries. I mean, I wonder if you can, you know, describe some of that and kind of going into black neighborhoods and listening to the music and, you know, meeting the girls and hanging out.
I think it was basically because we're English and cute or something that suddenly those other boundaries sort of disappeared. And you could just get along with people no matter, because you didn't realize the depth of some of the problems that people are up against, you know. And it was, I mean, it would only come in hard, you know, when you saw the chain gangs. So, whoa, this is real. And, otherwise, I think America, basically, especially black America, sort of took us a little more to their hearts, because so we were different, and we had no contact with the problems that they usually had, you know, with white people. So, in a way, I did my bit for integration.
You know, as the Stones started to get bigger and the 60s kind of moved along, there, you know, you guys were kind of embroiled. You know, your tour in 1969 I mean, that was one of the most raucous times in U.S. history, and the tour itself was, you know, an amazing event. It was really the first time you guys had been on the road in a while, and I wonder if you could, you know, talk about how things had changed just between, you know, the kind of a much more innocent, you know, earlier time in a way, and what seemed like a much kind of shakier environment towards the late 60s.
I don't think you can really describe the late 60s or even the early 70s in America without mentioning one word, which is Vietnam. This changed the whole dynamics of what was going on. Guys had been drafted, right? Guys you'd met a couple of years ago who were just, you know, saying, well, I want to play guitar, I want to do this, and suddenly, you know, oh, where's Tommy gone? You know, he's over there, and or he's come back in a body bag, and that was a difference. I mean, 69, particularly that year, it was apparent that there was a big thing going on and changing, you know, and you were only just sort of part of it. I mean, for instance, Altamont, there was absolutely no cops, no security at all, and there you've got 500,000 people, and there ain't nobody to wipe their noses, you know. I mean, I was quite amazed in retrospect that wasn't a real disaster. It was right on the cusp.
You know? I mean, letting alone you know, stuff like somebody punching Mick Jagger in the face like 5 minutes after you arrive. I mean, I remember in the movie, like while you guys were performing, and this is before anything really happened, like a dog just trots across the stage in front of you. It just was such an image of things being completely out of control.
It was, except for the Hells Angels.
Yes.
You know, that's the security, you know. And, whoa, okay, but I can't get out of here, so we've got to get along, you know. But it was touch and go. And I was only saying this to describe at that point in America that there was very little control going on. I guess most of the cops are already in Vietnam. I mean, and so people were left to sort of govern themselves, you know, and some people could make really bad decisions, like putting the Hells Angels in control.
Nonetheless, I mean, that period, you know, you guys just, you know, reissued Exile on Main Street, but that period from, say, 68 to 72, it was an amazing run for the Rolling Stones. You know, you had Beggar's Banquet and Sticky Fingers and Let It Bleed and Exile on Main Street. And it's always seemed to me that there was something about that transition and that chaos, some of the kind of edgier emotions of that time, that as difficult as it was, that you guys fed on creatively. I wonder if that was in any way your experience.
Probably not consciously. I mean, you can get caught up when it's such a large change and drift of feelings. And making those albums, it seemed very easy at the time. As you say, we were on a roll. We were working a lot, and songs were just popping out all over the place. I can't say really how much one thing influences you more than another, because you do get swept along in the general tide of feelings. Obviously, something was happening here, and we were trying to put our finger on it, I think. In a way, what can you do except sort of mirror or express what you're hearing around you? I mean, that's basically what a writer does, and it's what a musician does, trying to calm everybody down a little, or try to put certain thoughts into music and to crystallize them a little. Whether you're successful or not, I don't know.
Were there other musicians, we talked a little bit about the Beatles and a kind of creative competition or something. Were there other, you know, artists, at that time that you looked at as, you know, your competition, or someone that you kind of thought, well, they did this, or
Not competition, no. Inspiration, which I was basically listening to an awful lot of rhythm and blues, and there were some of the best records being made at that time in that genre, if that's what you want to call it. But incredibly creative. Motown was doing amazing stuff. And the fact that they had that one band that sort of basically translated everything. And a lot of producers like Burt Burns. There was just stuff popping out all over the place, you know. And I mean, to us, you know, that just to be able to turn a radio dial and maybe get 5 or 6 stations was like amazing, you know, coming from England where you maybe got 2, you know.
How important was someone like Bob Dylan to you?
Bob's an inspiration to all, always, and he'll always be. Came out in defiance of all the odds, right? But great songs, you know, beautifully expressed and beautifully written. And he had a large effect, I don't say on the Stones particularly, but just all round. John Lennon was incredibly impressed with Bob, right from the word go. And he also put a new slant on how you could write songs, and do they all have to be 3 minutes long? You know, or if you need a little more time to express what you want to say, take it, and do it. So, and we sort of took that along with us, you know, and we started doing 11-minute tracks and stuff. But all of these guys, and Bob particularly, has opened up possibilities. Probably a lot to do with the fact that the long-playing album was becoming the preferred method of recording. So you didn't have to rely on a hit every 3 months or every 2. You weren't into that. You could get out of that grind of you know, Tin Pan Alley a little, and people expected an album as a viable means to express yourself, which obviously gives the artist a lot more time to be able to, you know, to come up with the stuff, you know.
Oh, by that time, you know, the Rolling Stones had become, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world. You know, you've talked about, you know, heroin and drugs as being almost a kind of way to handle stardom and certain aspects of that fame that were complicated for you. I wonder if you could, you know, say a little bit about that.
Drugs, you know, they seep into your life. You're not really aware of it at first. My first feeling was about that. I mean, I'm working with these guys that are, you know, old, and I'm on the road. And we're 19, 20 years old, and it's taken its toll on us, you know, the road work. You know, and these guys are older, and they're all together, and you say, how do you do this, man? You know, I mean, what's the secret? You know, well, you take one of these, you smoke a little of that, and you go, the penny drops, you know. But at the same time, it was all backstage and sort of secret, you know. I tell you what, right now, ladies and gentlemen, kind of in a moment, I do need to take a break. Is it all right? I'll be right back. All right?
Okay. Talk amongst yourselves. <It's> just...
Yeah.
Sorry about that, but that's better.
Well, you were saying, we were talking about drugs, yes.
Oh, as yeah. getting in is easy, getting out is difficult. You know, it took me a while. And don't recommend it really to anybody, except that what happens is what happens. It seems perfectly natural at the time, and nobody was arguing, you know. So I went ahead. I really don't really say much more about drugs because I could give you a lecture all night about the, you know, about the quality and. But anyway, all my news is out of date, I'm telling you.
I love you, Daddy.
Thank you, sweetheart.
You know, while all that was going on, you know, the Stones were obviously still out there. I mean, I wonder, you know, the one thing that always seemed to me to distinguish the Rolling Stones from from many other bands, obviously, is performance. You know, I mean, that it always seemed to be such an essential aspect, you know, of what the Stones were about. You know, and I wonder if you could just talk about that. You know, the moment that you realized, like, that on stage, this band was going to be able to do something that maybe, you know, no one else really had been able to do.
There's an aspect about going on stage that is. It's always exciting because you don't know what's going to happen next, and you only get one take. This is not like making records or anything. It's, you know, once you're on, it's a full steam ahead. I mean, from my point of view, I'm watching Mick's ass. I'm trying to cover every move.
Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Great. Yes, well, anyway, I'm covering Mick's ass. that's the way, you know, from my point of view on stage, and trying to keep the whole band together, is I have to make sure that he's supported wherever he goes in the room, whatever he does, so that he feels totally, totally confident that no matter what he does, that the band will be there, even if it means switching beats and rhythms, and you know, as long as he's feeling comfortable. That was the whole point, like a safety net in a way. But at the same time, you know, when things are going well, you want to just prod it a little bit and get a little more out. Come on. It all depends on the circumstances. It depends on the weather and things like that, which you can't have any control over. But with Mick, I had a minimal amount of control in that at least he'd know that I'm there behind him leading the way.
You know, you talk in the book about the lead singer syndrome, you know, and mm-hmm. the relationship of the lead singer to a band. I mean, clearly, I mean, the story of you and Mick is an old, complex story. But, you know, if you could just describe that process of, you know, that relationship between, you know, the guy up front singing the songs, the band behind him, and you know, kind of how that's worked, you know, for you and Mick, for the Rolling Stones?
It's a strange balance of things, but as I say, for a lead singer, for the front man, so to speak, it's important that he feels like totally confident in that, you know, that he has a band behind him that's not going to fall apart if he tries anything. You know, be ludicrous, if you like, Mick, you know, we'll be there, you know. At the same time, the band might not feel the same way about the lead singer some days. But it's all tossed up in the air, and every gig is different. This is why I never got bored doing this stuff. Because take the Stones on stage, 1963 or now, it's still that same sense of adventure, of you know, things. And also, you want things to, you don't want everything to be rote. That's the antithesis of rock and roll. And, so yeah, we can rock, and occasionally we do roll. And that's when I like it.
The you know, during the 80s, you and Mick had hard times. You know, there were a lot of disagreements. It seemed as if the Rolling Stones were going to break up at times. And that led to your solo career in many ways. I mean, I remember very early on, you're once saying, I don't ever want to be in a situation of having to decide, you know, is this song mine or is this song for the Rolling Stones? But then you found yourself in that situation. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about that moment and that experience and what it was like.
In retrospect, it proved very interesting for myself, because since everything I'd done up to then was, I mean, I write songs for Mick to be able to sing. You know, I'm one of his, I don't say tailor-made, because I'm not that good a tailor. But, you know, I say, for example, a Midnight Rambler. Ain't nobody else could sing that except Mick, you know. And I wrote it for him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or Give Me Shelter. I think you look for those things, and those are maybe the examples of how we work at our best, you know. The rest of it, hey, it is only rock and roll, and sometimes you're flinging things in the air and you don't know if they're going to hit the deck. And it's, well, where did that go? You know, levitation is possible.
One of the things in people's responses to the book, one of the things that's really been striking is people's response to the way that you write about, you know, the various women in your life. Someone like Ronnie Spector or Anita Pallenberg, of course, and you know, your wife Patty now, and you know, even women that you knew more casually. I mean, people are surprised. I mean, that, you know, the kind of toughness in your image, but a kind of you know, generosity and sweetness in terms of a lot of what you have to say about, you know, all of those people.
I found it very futile to say anything bad about women. It just doesn't swing. I love them dearly, but then if I expanded on it, then we'd be here all night. Yeah, I'd like to leave women just there, you know. I could swing with them. I love them dearly. And I'm already going on too much.
You know, you've talked about, you know, songwriting a little bit. You know, clearly, you know, you and Mick were locked in a kitchen to write your first song. And, you know, since then, obviously, you know, it's been a long time since then. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, that process, both, you know, writing songs with Mick, writing songs with someone like Steve Jordan, you know, writing songs yourself.
Well, sometimes with Mick, you know, I keep looking around for a new kitchen. Let's try that again. And I've always done everything. I've never really written by myself. I've never really liked to do anything by myself, except sleep. Everything else I've done is a joy of collaboration, of bouncing off of somebody else's ideas. And the same with the guitar playing with the Stones. I mean, virtuoso I'm not, and I never intended to be and wanted to be, but I'm very interested in playing something off against the other guy and seeing what comes back. And as Ronnie would and I call it, the ancient form of weaving. It's you can't tell where the needle went in or where it came out, you know. But it's a different thread. That's what makes it fun to me, and that's what turns me on. is the collaboration between musicians and between guys that, you know, writing. I couldn't do it in a vacuum, mind you, not that I've been in one.
In terms of the other, you know, musicians in the band, you know, going back and listening to a lot of the early Stone stuff, it seems to me more and more what I hear in those records is the importance of Charlie Watts. And I wonder if, you know, you could talk about him, you know, just as a player and as a person, and, you know, and his significance for you.
Charlie, I could say so much about Charlie. Really the most solidest drummer that I've ever worked with. Probably because we've worked together for so long that we can almost second guess what's going to happen, and sometimes even try and outguess ourselves just for the fun of it, and I usually screw up. But Charlie's a gentleman. I don't know how he does it, quite honestly. You know, he takes everything so smooth. Sometimes I can get mad and stuff, but I've never seen Charlie, or only once ever, show any temper or anything. He's an incredible calming influence in the band. The central point between Mick and myself that can both make us feel kind of stupid at times. Like, come on, guys, you know what I mean? And to me, it's just a sheer privilege to work with Charlie Watts, and probably the big blessing in the band.
You know, I'm sure... I'm sure the meaning of, what the Rolling Stones represent has kind of evolved for you over time, you know, and, after you did get back together in the late 80s and started touring again, it just seems like things got bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, and in a way, maybe even in a way that you never even was possible before. At this stage, you know, what do the Rolling Stones kind of signify to you? I mean, do you still think of yourself as, you know, as that being your primary identity?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, after all of these years, it'd be very difficult to separate myself from the Stones in any coherent form. You know, when I say I usually mean we. You work with a bunch of guys that hard and that long. I mean, I really find it hard to express this, except to say, hey, ask Duke Ellington, ask Count Basie how it's like to keep a band together for that long, you know, and to still get off on it. And Ray Charles, too, I'll add, you know, these cats. I mean, they're running big bands, still managed to keep a vital thing going throughout all of those years. And there's something to it that you don't want to let go, you know. You just say, let me see how far this band will go. Go on, you know, drop.
What's the trick?
Not dropping.
Well, one of the things that you talk about in the book is, you know, the idea of you're liking things that endure. I mean, you're not necessarily interested in, you know, just the sort of latest thing that's happening. You like things that last, you know, in just kind of all aspects of your life. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what that comes from. Do you...
I don't know. I wonder myself. I don't know. I've usually found that things that I liked have lasted, that there's some continuity to it, whether it was books or movies, or, you know, there's certain, you say, this is not just for now, you know. It's after all, a lot of what we live with is just for now, and you throw it away tomorrow, and why not music and other stuff? But there's certain things that you have a feeling that have a little more to say rather than just for today, maybe they've, you know, say for, you know, next year, or, you know, next century, if I have my way.
We were just back actually in the in the special collections of the library and looking at, you know, some of these objects that have really, you know, lasted a long time. You know, are there, you know, when you think about, you know, the Stones' career, I mean, I'm sure it's very difficult for you to, you know, to identify specific moments of you know, particular importance. But I'm going to ask you if there are things, you know, where you just say, you know, that was a real high point. If you could pick two or three that you, in your own mind, just go like, wow, that was really a special moment. That was something we really achieved. That was great.
I suppose if I go back, to the first time we got in a recording studio and they paid us. That was, wow, yeah, because that's all I wanted to do, and that's all we wanted to do was to make records, to be able to at least put things down for at least a short posterity. You know, I didn't think it was going to be this long, but that was the desire. And I think that the first time we got in the studio, one for be for me, like the big high point, the first one. Second, I don't know, it was probably playing New York Academy of Music. I mean, the first time to hit the stage in America was, and they're actually paying, and they're actually clapping and stuff. That was a real high point for the whole band, you know, to be able to come to America and start to become part of everything. And the third one, I ain't been there yet.
As you know, as the Stones have evolved and over time and gotten written about and films made about, in your own book even, you know, one of the things you tangle with is a sense of image. You know, there's expectations of you. You know, when people meet Keith Richards, they think of a certain way. They think of certain attitudes that, you know, may or may not correspond to who you are. I wonder if you can talk about kind of living side by side with that image of Keith Richards.
I mean, some of it is probably fairly accurate because, I mean, these things don't happen by themselves. Sometimes you feel that you're a little out of sync with the image. You know? It's 30 years since I was a junkie, you know. I mean, but I still carry that ball and chain, you know. Apart from that, fame is something you have to deal with. I mean, everybody individual in that way. I sort of grown into it. You know, there was a point I was ready to, you mean I have to be famous to do this? You know, and then the answer is yeah. Yeah, sorry. You can't do this and nobody knows who you are, right? So, okay, I get it. And, so I slowly grew into fame the hard way. And of course, most of it is just, it's fun, you know. Hey, what's so hard about being famous, really, you know? Hey, what I'd say, well, a little difficult to go to the movies. You know, sometimes I don't feel like going down to the supermarket, you know. But you get over that. I mean, it's just part of the job eventually. And, I mean, I hate to say, I hate to feel that I ever took it for granted. But because, hey, I mean, you're all my mates. You're all my, you know, you made me. And you've given this band of mine such support over the years that, you know, I couldn't turn tail on it now. So I'll be as famous as you like, you know.
Well, within that, you know, there's, recently there have been a number of really interesting stories about your book and about you in the New York Times, and hundreds of comments from people, many of whom started sharing their Keith stories. One was you met a couple on the street. They had just gotten married. You were on University Place, I think it was 1977. They asked if they could take a picture with you, and you went into the store, and you bought a pack of cigarettes and a rose for the bride, and then you took some pictures. Another was by the guy who painted your house in Connecticut, who described your coming out and engaging with them in a conversation about what the approach to this particular job should be, and at one point, in the middle of it, just saying, "Oh, and by the way, I'm Keith." And those and stories like them just suggest a degree to which, you've kind of kept your feet on the ground despite, a life of just tremendous renown. I was wondering what you felt were the qualities that helped you do that. I mean, it's difficult, and we know a lot of people haven't been so good at it.
Probably the fear of my feet not being on the ground kept them there, you know. Levitation is a trick I never quite got the hang of. But I just always thought it was important. I'm very, very grateful that people appreciated, what I've done. I think it's I think you're all way over the top on this. But, it just goes with the territory. The idea of being, Tony, give me a new hat. This one's not big enough. I just try and keep it the way it is. I know who I am, so I don't need to fly up there to find out.
One of the interesting passages in the book also is you're writing about your father. In many ways, you've kind of walked up to a lot of edges and pretty fearlessly. But you talk about when your father had been absent from your life for a long time and when you were going to meet him again, that you were really scared about it and very nervous and wanted his approval. And I wonder if you could talk about that. About that relationship. I mean, having become a father yourself, and
well, I'd left home in a cloud of disgrace, I suppose, and without getting my dad's okay or any sign after 20 years, and so I still felt probably inside that he was still a bit pissed off with me, and. For ruining the family name and all of that. Not that he had one, but... Nevertheless, dragging it once more through the mire. I think it was the only time I can remember actually feeling, chicken, which is why I asked Ronnie Wood to come with me to meet my dad, and that that's your idea of a bodyguard. Well...
But you managed to renew that relationship and really have a kind of rich and deep relationship. And I remember one moment again from the first time I interviewed you, where you were talking about children and what it was like and, just how exciting it was. And it was, again, an element of you that, sort of countered the Keith Richards kind of... pirate or unconnected from any connection. You spoke, again, so kind of sweetly about your children. And I wonder if you could talk about parenthood.
Well, there's a couple in the room right now. it's one of those things that until you do it, suddenly you've got this little creature that's dependent upon you. Up until then, you can sink or swim. Doesn't matter. Nobody's going to be relying on you. But once you have children, without you knowing it, a sense of responsibility comes into play. Don't look at me for the way to deal with this. I recognized it immediately. And to try and bring up kids... and do what I do at the same time is a damn good at juggling act, I can tell you. But really, when it comes down to it, it's the same thing. wife, kids, family. These things don't. Nothing can come between that. That is. That's numero uno. And also that the kids grow up, with some fresh air and a fairly sort of unbiased attitude around them, not being too aware that, father's far too famous for his own good. And trying to just keep people together. I mean, what is a family? It's a family is somebody that sticks together. And luckily mine all have. Bless your hearts.
Just as we come close to a close here, I wanted to ask you about your other family, the Rolling Stones. Are you guys going to go out again? I mean, are you going to record again? What is the...
Yeah, why not? Well, you won't keep me away. I'll do my best to chat the other guys into it. But I think there'll be something next year. I think we're rocking.
Well, Keith Richards, thank you
Anthony,
so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.